This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated books and comic show here on the network. I am your host, Matthew Rushing, and with me, my co-host, my co-pilot, Dan Gunther. Dan, how's it going?
Hi, Matthew. As usual, not too bad, and always really great to be here. You know, just kind of sitting around planning out writing my memoirs, really. I'm not sure what to call it, but I don't know how exciting they'll be so far, but hopefully not too bad.
I have one suggestion on what not to call it. Don't call it Dan the Man. I think that may just be overdone.
Yeah, you know, that might be. Hold on, let me just scratch something out here. Okay.
Well, I mean, it's sure to be a fascinating read because nothing but exciting things happen in Canada, which, you know, I mean, just this summer, you guys hosted the World Cup. I mean, America won, but that's still exciting, and it happened in Canada.
Yeah. Well, anyway, moving on, what are you up to, Matthew?
Well, sadly enough, honestly, we don't have anything in news today. The only thing that I wanted to remind people, because it's a big deal, James Swallow's brand new book, Sight Unseen, his newest Titan book, is out. It came out today as of the day we were recording here. But by the time you get this show, it'll already be out. By the time you're listening to this show in the future, it'll be out. So check out James Swallow's Sight Unseen. Honestly, great thing about this book so far, I'm not that far in, about probably 25% done, Dan, and there's already some great references to some people from Trek FM and some things from Trek FM in the book. So if you're an ardent listener here, you have some Easter eggs in this book, and I'm really interested to see people begin to pick them out and post them on the Babel Conference.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. It was neat to see the couple that I've found so far, so... yeah, let us know if you find them and you know, what you found and what you thought.
Well, speaking of that, it's a perfect time to remind everybody, obviously, that Literary Treks is part of the Trek FM network. We have 20 different shows plus special feeds. We've got so much for you here on the network. You can go to iTunes.com/TrekFM and you can find all the shows. You can also find us on the web at trek.fm, and that's a great place to go. We have all the shows listed there. We got the show pages, all the links that we have on the show pages, things we talk about, all the different places you can find us. Of course, we're on Twitter at trekfm, Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. If you'd like to contact us and tell us some of the things that you've been seeing in Sight Unseen that have to do with Trek FM, the little Easter eggs in there, go to trek.fm/contact. Just choose a show there. You can send us your thoughts and what you've been thinking about that book and maybe some of the things you've picked up on. And we also have a Goodreads group, which is a great place to go because it lets you know what's coming up on the show, the things that we're going to be doing next. And it also has a great place for you to see all the different books and comics that we've covered throughout the couple of years, 3 years, that we've been going on Literary Treks now. So there's the bookshelf there. You can take a look, see what we've been covering, what we are going to cover, and then we've got the great discussions going on there as well. And then, of course, Dan, I think probably one of the best places for people to really interact if they're a listener here of Literary Treks is the Babel Conference.
Definitely, Matthew. It's a great Facebook group where we discuss all the recent shows of all the shows on Trek FM, as well as just great general Star Trek discussion and general geek discussion. So it's a really great place to connect with the people who do these shows and a great place for us to talk to our listeners. So
yeah, it really is. So just go to Facebook, type Babel in the search field there, or you can go to any of the show pages at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Now, Dan, if you're not too busy scribbling down some notes for your memoirs, how about we jump into our interview with David A. Goodman and talk about somebody else's memoirs?
Oh, that sounds pretty exciting. Yeah, let's talk about the story of Starfleet's greatest captain.
Dan, I am really excited tonight because we have a great guest with us to talk about a brand new book that has just come out. And it's definitely something that I think is going to be a treat for Trek fans out there everywhere. It's the autobiography of James T. Kirk by the man himself. And we have the editor with us tonight of that book. and so I'm wondering what kind of wibbly wobbly, timey wimey things he had to go through to be the editor of this book. But David A. Goodman, it is great to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much, man. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, really happy to have you on for sure.
Thanks, Dan.
You did Federation First 150 Years, which was a really...
That's right.
Just a really great book about just kind of the history of the Federation from, you know, before Archer all the way forward. And you ended that book, if I'm remembering correctly, after the Kittimer Accords were finally signed after Star Trek VI.
Yes, that was it was like 150th anniversary of the founding of the Federation is when I ended it, which was shortly after the events of Undiscovered Country.
So the idea for, and just kind of the, I guess the kernel, the genesis, where did it come from, this idea? Okay, what if we did a book that was the autobiography of, you know, Star Trek's most famous person?
You know, it's interesting. The idea was not initially mine. It was the idea of Dave Rossi, who I worked with on Star Trek Enterprise, who was a producer on Star Trek Enterprise. And he was the person who hooked me up with CBS Consumer Products to do the first book. And then also he thought, what about an autobiography of Kirk? And I have to say, I had a lot of resistance to it at the beginning. I didn't know, honestly, how I would approach the book, writing in Kirk's voice. I felt like it was a real challenge, but everyone was so excited about this idea, and it was the kind of thing that I just couldn't say no to, and it was also the kind of idea that I didn't want to let someone else write. I felt like I would attack it in a way that, as a reader, I would be... whenever I write something that's Star Trek or related to Star Trek, I'm a fan first, so I don't want to write something that would piss me off by getting something wrong, something important wrong. And so I really was sort of driven to do this book the way I would want it to be done. And I started thinking about, once the idea was sold, I just started thinking about, what is this book? I mean, what is going to make this book different than all the other books out there that play in that space of the stuff we didn't see, or the stuff that happened right before or right after the stuff we did see? You know what I mean? So much of Trek lit is that.
Is oh, life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here's Kirk and Gary Mitchell on their first assignment, or here are the events that happened right between Star Trek VI and Generations, here is this character from Best of Both Worlds now on this other ship, and so with the Kirk book, it was, okay, how am I going to do that? I don't want to just do that because there are plenty of good writers who are doing that kind of book. I wanted the book to be also be something else, to say, to figure out a way to make this character, this hero, to so many people, more human in a way that doesn't contradict anything we already know about.
For you, as you were thinking about that, and honestly, I guess, what was it like trying to put yourself in the mindset of who James Kirk is, and what research did you do to help yourself really get in what you felt like would be the frame set for Kirk himself sitting down to write his life story?
Well, I mean, I'm as big a Star Trek fan as anybody, so I didn't really have to do any research about Star Trek. I mean, I'm always researching Star Trek. I'm always watching it. I'm always reading about it. It's not, I imagine your audience knows what I'm talking about. It's an endless passion, and you guys obviously know about it as well. It's like you never get tired of it. You never get tired of it.
Definitely,
And as a result, you're always well-researched on it, and there might have been things that I double-checked. But for me, the idea was, okay, it's not just Kirk as we've seen him. We also want, I went back to sort of some what I would consider source material, so that actually source material in other genres. So for instance, I had read all the Hornblower books, and since Horatio Hornblower was an inspiration for Kirk, I went back and reread a couple of them, especially sort of some of the earlier ones of what it was like, the First Command. I also read a couple of actual nonfiction autobiographies, one Norman Schwarzkopf's autobiography, because he went to West Point, and I thought that there might be some things to draw from for that, for Kirk, and for the Academy. And I was really trying to find, and I also read some biography of Dwight Eisenhower. And then I also am a big fan of the author Herman Luke, who wrote a book called The Kane Mutiny, which is a great book about, it's a great novel that takes place during World War II. And it's a great novel about what it's like for a lieutenant serving in the Navy or an ensign. And I wanted some feelings of that, of like what Kirk's feelings would be in all those places, like at the Academy and then on his first assignment. So that was kind of some research that I did there. And then I had to write a whole section about the farm on Earth, which was really, I wanted to somehow create this 23rd century idea of a farm and not have it be boring, because I was generally bored by that idea of life on a farm. It just doesn't sound interesting to me. So how do I make that interesting? And the way I made that interesting was getting into Kirk's character. So that was some of the research that I did. And then it was just thinking about who this man is. And so, and this, I mean, I think this might upset readers, although I'm getting a good response from them. Did you guys read the book?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, I'll be interested to hear what you think about it. So the thing that I really settled on was, that's an important piece of his life, was the fact that he was a father during the entire run of the original series. That is, if you do the math, backtracking from Wrath of Khan, David Marcus was alive and a child when Kirk was captain of the Enterprise, during the original season. And I'm thinking to myself that even in Wrath of Khan, where Carol Marcus says, well, you know, I wanted you to go away, the fact is, Kirk, speaking for myself as both a father and a son, when a man makes a decision, when a man leaves his children, he's making a decision.
Right.
He's choosing his career over family. And as soon as I made that connection, a lot of other things started to fall into place, because throughout the original series, the writers of the original series were constantly pointing out that Kirk was lonely, that Kirk was married to his ship, and couldn't have like in naked time a beach to walk on with a beautiful woman. The way he fell out of love with the Dolmen of Elos was because he was already in love with the Enterprise. The loneliness in the episode Requiem for Methuselah. There's constant in City on the Edge of Forever. There's all this talk about this guy is lonely. And I thought, why not even add this further thing onto it that doesn't contradict that, which is this guy gave up a life of a family because of his drive to become this great starship commander. And then going even further, delving into the character, well, why? If, you know, why, and without getting too psychological, I thought the best way to that would be if there was some bit of his childhood that was a little broken, not toxic and not anything that would be hard to swallow, but perhaps his parents' marriage had some difficulties. And that would lead the child, I think, to maybe say, you know what, I want to be home. I want to be out in space. And it was really, that was really it. That was really the sort of the math that I did that gave me a story to tell and gave me Kirk's story as he's telling it and saying, this is why I am who I am. And it doesn't contradict anything we see and actually helps support it and make, you know, the heroism and who he was both great and tragic.
Well, and it does a good job to, you know, humanize somebody that everybody kind of deifies, you know, when it comes to these kind of characters. I was just thinking of, there's a new book out called Killing Reagan, and I was reading the flap for it, Bill O'Reilly's new book, and just the idea of Reagan... He's a man, you know, people love him, but he was also just a man, and he had foibles and fears and bad days and good days. And the same thing with Kirk, you know, he's not perfect, and he had just as many things going on.
Reagan's a great guy to bring up because his dad was this raging drunk and, you know, he had to sort of drag him in off the porch at night because he'd come home like falling down drunk. And, you know, you think of, and here he was, this kind of great man for the country at the time, but he came from a place that was really kind of dark and also very relatable. So, yeah, no, that was very, very much in my mind for Kirk was, how do I connect him? And I think that most people, I wanted to do something that a lot of people could relate to. Like, we've all had some kind of awakening about the imperfections of our parents' marriages or a desire to leave home or, you know, a drive to succeed or difficulty making relationships. Or these are things that I think I wanted to add this human element. And again, I wasn't doing anything that the writers of Star Trek hadn't already done. That's the thing, is that all I was doing was sort of pulling it together. But the fact is, again, if you look at the original series, he's a guy who makes mistakes. He will yell at McCoy and then in the next scene apologize to McCoy. I shouldn't have yelled at you. You know, he makes, you know, in Tomorrow's Yesterday, he makes this kind of big blunder of turning the tractor beam on the jet fighter. I mean, he's not perfect ever in the show, which is, I think, one of the reasons that he's such a great character. He's not the perfect hero.
I completely agree with you.
Well, one thing, I mean, hearing you talk about, you know, Kirk's life and stuff, it's pretty clear that you're a really big Star Trek fan, and reading the novel or the book, you get that impression as well. And one thing that I thought was really clever was how you would take small clues from filmed Trek and kind of spin the story off in a completely unexpected way. I'm thinking, for example, Kirk's line in the motion picture about it being difficult to convince Nagura, and we see exactly how he did that, which is, you know, not at all what I was expecting. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your motivation for kind of, you know, doing more unexpected things like that in the book.
Well, I mean, a lot of fans don't like it when you play with their expectations. On the other hand, I do think that I was sort of driven with the idea of I wanted to do, as a writer, I had to keep myself interested. And so when I came up with what I did with Nagura throughout the book, it was really of interest to me because I think it played into things we'd already seen in Star Trek. We've all seen sort of right up to Next Generation, we saw bad admirals like in Ensign Row. There's that bad admiral, the Pegasus, Riker's old commanding officer. It was bad. There's always bad captains, bad. You know, that's one of the, and again, one of my favorite episodes of original Star Trek are the bad captain episodes, like, you know, Ron Tracy and Matt Decker and Commodore Stocker. And, you know, I love those flawed guys. And I thought what I did with Nagura didn't in any way contradict things we hadn't already seen in filmed Star Trek. And I liked this idea of filling out the universe in a way that wasn't always positive, wasn't always perfect. That what's great about the Federation and Earth is that it's a paradise. But what I like about it is that the system of the Federation is this perfect bureaucracy that keeps the bad attitudes of human beings who still have not perfected themselves from causing too much harm. And I thought that there were always sort of signs in original Trek of politics, of politics of admirals, and, you know, that Amok Time is a great example. Kirk's being sent on this mission. It's clear Kirk thinks this is just a waste of time mission. He's willing to violate orders to save Spock life because it's just, he just doesn't think it's an important mission. But the admiral, whose name is now slipping my mind, and now I'm losing my credibility as a Star Trek fan because I can't remember the admiral's name in the much time, but it'll come back to me. You guys are trying to think of it too, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm actually thinking about it right now. I'm like, oh, come on, brain, come on.
Fitzpatrick, come on, maybe. One of those.
Admiral, Komak, Admiral Komak.
Oh, yeah.
In my book as well.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
I beat you guys. Admiral Komak is clearly like, you know, this is going to send ripples clear to the Klingon Empire. That's just politics. It's not important. No one's lives are at stake, whatever. And so even though you say it's in unexpected ways, I'm really drawing on a lot of the things that I liked about original Star Trek. That was that there was dimension to the universe, that everybody didn't always act perfectly. Everybody wasn't always doing things for, you know, great high standing reasons. And that just created this character of Nagura, who is sort of a character who may have had influence on the people who did the conspiracy in Star Trek VI. I mean, in Star Trek VI, there's a conspiracy between Starfleet admirals, Klingon military, and the Romulan ambassador to kill the Klingon, the chairman of the Klingon High Council. I mean, think about that. That's not perfect. Who are those Federation guys who participated in that? So, and what would be their motivation? And that's the other thing too, is that bad guys never think they're bad guys. Bad guys think they're in real life. Bad guys think they're doing things to help. They're doing the right thing. And so that was the other thing that I had to do in the book was Nagura is an antagonist, but he's not a bad guy. He thinks he's doing what he needs to do to protect the Federation.
Yeah,
did that answer your question, Dan, or did I not answer that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. That one in particular, I thought that was really interesting, kind of tying that to the Warhawks in Star Trek VI there, because, yeah, it almost does seem to come out of left field when you watch Star Trek VI, but, you know, with kind of supplemental material like this, you kind of see that it kind of makes sense that those attitudes might have been around for quite a while.
Right, and it does seem natural given what happens in the original series and the attitude towards the Klingons back then, and even what happens in Enterprise with the stuff we did there. So it's sort of you know, it can connect. It sort of connect. It connected. I mean, I had to think of it, but it was like it made it more interesting. Made a more interesting story to me, and that was really the reason I did. And also, when Kirk says that thing in the shuttle pod to Scotty, you know, that what you're doing an imitation of Scotty, saying you're right, it was hard to convince Nagura. I really wanted to make it hard. I wanted Kirk to do something that was really like risky and difficult. Mm-hmm. And in my book, it has real serious consequences.
Yeah. And that's the other thing I notice is a lot of what you did in this book kind of adds weight to a lot of these little throwaway lines that we get throughout Star Trek. And like I said, that one in particular really stuck out to me. So now the next time I watch the motion picture and Kirk says, yeah, it was pretty hard. It really kind of, that's going to be in my mind, and that's pretty cool.
Well, yeah, and that also played into something in the motion picture that McCoy said, you know, again, as fans, we want to see Kirk back in the chair. We want to see him on the Bridge of the Enterprise. But he takes the ship away from Decker, who was kind of this son figure to him, you know, and what was that about? And I was really trying to fill that in this book, is like, how did that relationship start? What was that about? And then how much, and really playing the realness of like, he really screws Decker over. I mean, he put him in charge of the ship. Decker spends 2 years trying to get the ship ready, finally going to get to take it out. And then Kirk says, oh, guess what? It's mine now. In real life, Kirk's a real dick. And I thought that was really important to say, okay, well, why is he doing this?
Well, that's one of those things where there's a side of what makes Kirk great that also makes him not so great. I mean, it's the foibles of human nature, you know, that nobody's right. Perfect. And like, so even Kirk has things about him that, you know, some of it helps make him who he is. That's really, really good. And some of it's like, oh gosh, you should probably go to some therapy and work on that. Cause you know, that's not so great, man.
Right. Right. But as we're, you know, as we're Star Trek fans, we're with Kirk. So he's screwing someone over to get the Enterprise back. That's what we want too. We want him back on the Enterprise. We want, you know, so the writers of those movies can actually, you know, push him a little far to do things that in real life might not be so nice, but on the movie screen, it's like, yeah, Kirk's back.
With the canon and working with things, you know, obviously now with what we saw in the latest films that JJ did, talk about just kind of working with that canon and making it, you know, kind of meshing it together with what we have in the prime canon as well.
Well, there wasn't much that I had to do. I put the Kelvin in there, although I'm very dodgy about saying exactly where Kirk is born. I don't actually say that he was born on the Kelvin in the book. But just mentioning the Kelvin, I think, pisses some true fans off. I got a bunch of negative reviews on Amazon from people who didn't even read the book. They just, in the blurb, Kelvin was mentioned, and then that just said, nope, I'm done. And I like the Kelvin. I like the fact that Kirk's parents served together, and I use that as a jumping off point. I don't use the events of what happened in Star Trek as a jumping off point. Kirk's dad doesn't die in my book, and neither does his mother. You know, I used the names and those characters and a bit of that history in the name of the Captain of the Kelvin. But then from that point on, from Kirk's birth on, there really isn't anything to use in JJ's movies. Because this is Prime Universe. This is Prime Universe Kirk. So, I really didn't do anything after that. I like the opening of the first Star Trek movie a lot.
Yeah.
I think anybody who doesn't think that works as Star Trek is just being pissy. It's great.
Oh, it's awesome.
It's a great origin. Yeah, it's awesome. It's great. And, you know, a lot of fans have problems with with that movie. I love that movie too. I loved it all the way through. But the opening, to me, I think just that works. It's great. It's wonderful. As part of Star Trek, so I use pieces of that, but I actually don't actually say where he was born, just to sort of honestly, that was my intention was to try to have it both ways. It doesn't work because people see the Kelvin, and the people who'd be pissed off by that are pissed off by that.
Well, and you can't make every fan happy, but I mean, you as the writer also have to deal with the fact that that is part of the canon, and so it's.
Well, that was exactly my thinking, which is like, look, I'm a Star Trek. My guiding principle in this is, again, like, what do I do that I wouldn't be pissed off? And if a writer wrote an autobiography, if someone else wrote this autobiography and didn't reference the Kelvin and made up a new parents that didn't serve together and all this, it would bug me as a fan. So that was my guiding principle was that's what I want. I like that piece. I like the idea that piece could work as the beginning of the Prime universe. And I wanted to use pieces of that. And I love the design. I, you know, again, a lot of people don't like the set design of, how the J.J. Abrams movies portray engineering or whatever. But, I love that stuff. I thought that was a great reimagining.
It's kind of like being, honestly, a Star Wars fan. And it's like, you might not like the prequels, but you can't stop them from existing and being part of the story now.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's like, you can't, I think that as fans, we want the thing we had that was somehow ours. And we as fans, we all do what I did in this book. All fans do what I did, which is fill in all the hardcore fans. They fill in the blanks however they want. And because there are blanks, there are things that, you know, Starfleet Academy has never really been portrayed. Like, I guess we get a little bit of it in Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, but we don't really ever get a sense of like what this place was like. And in our minds, we filled it in our own way, mm-hmm. based on the mm-hmm. snippets that we've gotten. But again, that was like something that I had to sit down and sort of, okay, I need to figure this place out. Like, what is this place? And what's it like for Kirk to go there? And what's its purpose? And I engineered it back from what I knew. And I figured, what did this place have to be? And I'm sure that there are people who won't like my portrayal of Starfleet Academy, but I was drawing from the sources of the original series and of what Kirk said about it and what we saw about it. And that's just one example of something that I think some fans might not like of my book.
Mm. Well, one of the things that I found in this book that was really clever and a really interesting choice, and we should warn people that we are going to spoil things a little bit, kind of your approach to Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, I thought was really clever. And I think it's a choice that I really enjoyed. I think that that's one choice that might prove to be pretty controversial among some fans. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you came up with, you know, that angle for the story, because I'm really curious to see, you know, where in the process that idea came about.
Well, I've always had this idea that a piece of the idea I've always had, it didn't have actually anything to do with Star Trek V. And it was a short story that I was going to try to write that I was going to submit to one of the Star Trek fan short story collections many years ago. And the idea was that on the Roman planet in Breton Circuses, that Kirk had slept with Drusilla, the slave, and that she had a child. And that this child, and my short story took place in the Next Generation universe with Picard going back to this planet. And he finds that Kirk had an illegitimate kid that he didn't know about on this planet. And that because it's the 60s, equivalent of the 60s in television, such a big thing, and that Christianity, I mean, the Roman Empire is sort of fading, that this child grows up the son of the slave, and the slave tells the child who his father was, and that then there are all these other survivors of the Beagle who still live on the planet, who this child seeks out, and he sort of fills in the blanks himself of like what Federation is like and Starfleet, and he creates on this planet basically this planet's Star Trek TV series, that he becomes a writer and that he writes this Star Trek TV series. And so that the original short story that I never finished was Picard coming back and finding now on this planet 80 years later this almost religion built around Star Trek, this TV show, and he comes back and finds people in costume and fans, you know, cosplaying and all this stuff. And I ended up using some of the ideas of Star Trek as a religion in my Futurama episode. That's where that original idea came from. Was I just thought that was a funny idea that Star Trek becomes a TV show on this planet in the Star Trek universe. So that's where that idea came from. And so in the book, I altered it and made it because I had trouble in my mind making Star Trek V work in my book. And for one main reason, which is something that I just can't get past, which is the center of the galaxy is a black hole. And in Star Trek V, there's the Great Barrier at the center of the galaxy. And on the other side is, you know, Shakari. And I just don't, that was just a really tough buy for me to make. There are other sort of things like that in Star Trek that I was able to sort of explain away and whatever. And I just didn't like having to make that work in my book. It just didn't make any sense to me. So instead, I make Star Trek V a movie on that planet that Kirk and company go back to and get to see. And I think that there are plenty of fans who will be very angry about that. But I've also gotten some very good reaction.
Well, I personally thought it was pretty clever.
and that's more of a fun interlude in the book. It's not that important a piece of the book, but it's sort of that was how I wanted to handle it, because there were just things about Star Trek V, especially going to the center of the galaxy, and it only takes 6 hours to get to the center of the galaxy, which is also ridiculous, even with warp speed. I mean, there's just so many things, and I didn't like that there's a barrier inside the center of the galaxy, and there's also a barrier surrounding the galaxy in where no man was gone before, which is also something I kind of explain in the book by not explaining it, as saying there's no explanation for this. And because those are two sort of bits of science that I've always had trouble with. I'm not a scientist, and everything else I can sort of forgive, but for some reason those two things really bother me.
For you, you know, kind of weaving the story with Kirk, and talk about crafting all of the people that he kind of bumps into along the way, and the people that you were able to find a way to kind of make work with the Kirk story that you were telling, but also would be fun for the fans who have spent a lot of time with Star Trek to be like, oh, hey, Kirk bumped into them. That's awesome.
Well, give me an example of somebody that you
like Morgan Baston, you know, being his aide when he was admiral, and having been his yeoman, right. and like just the idea of somebody like that, and you know, that to me was like, I don't know where he came up with this, but I like it.
I think I was driven by, Morgan Batson was just, I wanted to do something where Kirk has a yeoman that's not a woman before he has yeoman Rand. Because in Kevin Wright Maneuver, it's very clear that Kirk is uncomfortable with yeoman Rand because she's a woman, an attractive woman. And that implies to me that if he's had a yeoman before, it was a guy. And I thought All right. And then, all right. So who are characters who might show up later in Star Trek who I can use? And I have to be very careful about that because, like, I don't want to use Chekhov, for instance. I don't want to use a real main character. And then that becomes my effort to sort of use somebody you wouldn't think of. And timing wise, given Batson's age and the very brief scene that we see him in Cause and Effect, is the right age that he could have been Kurt Hillman. And he becomes a captain, so he has a good career. And I just thought, and so, but that was after some searching of trying to think, okay, I got to think of a guy, you got to think of a crewman. There's sort of a limited number of crewmen in original series that I can use. Almost none, really. I mean, I guess I could have used DeSalle. I wanted to be a little bit more unexpected. And also, I'm also was really driven in any way possible to use characters from other series if possible. Obviously, using any characters from Next Generation is mm-hmm. almost impossible. So this was a great opportunity to do that. And then I'm also driven in all those cases to make sure that the story that I do that reference for you, the fan, and I'm glad you caught it, but I don't stop the story for it. Like, I don't really spend a lot of time talking about that character. He serves a purpose to the story. We don't spend a lot of time talking about that guy. So the reference is there for the fan. For anybody else reading it, it's just a character.
Yeah.
Like, if you're an original series fan, let's say you never watched Next Generation, or you don't remember Morgan Batson from that episode, you could just read it and you would be like, "Yo, here's another character."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that makes it a lot of fun because it works for both, and you know that's really the goal, is to get anybody reading the book, and I think the book does a good enough job that you could give it to somebody who doesn't know a lot about Trek and they'd enjoy it, and then you can give it to a longtime fan and they can enjoy it as well. And you know, that's the best kind of story for Star Trek, which, you know, with the lit universe being what it is, it can be hard to jump into something in the middle right now because there's a lot of continuity. Right. But this gives you that opportunity to maybe bring somebody in who hasn't really tried this before.
Well, that was definitely one of my goals. I mean, I don't think, like, my editor at the publishing house was not a huge Star Trek fan. So she knew, I made her watch a couple episodes, and so she was sort of all the way, probably all the way over to the far end of the spectrum of somebody who could read it and enjoy it, because she'd seen Star Trek, she was familiar with it. A great example of someone like too far off, who just was my sister, my older sister. I sent her a copy of the book, and she tried to read it, and her first question was, after the opening page, okay, so who's McCoy? So I thought, okay, this is somebody who can't read the book. If you don't know, you need to know who the characters are. You do need to know who Spock and McCoy are, and Kirk. I think if you just have that base knowledge, then you can read the book.
Know that you had kind of expressed the idea on the Trek BBS as maybe doing an autobiography from Spock's perspective. I was also thinking just this idea, how interesting it would be to have one from McCoy's perspective, because there's really so much about that character that you could just write a really great book about, because there's so much about him to fill in. Any chance of something like that coming down the pipeline, maybe?
I think so. I mean, I hope so. It would have to be approved by CBS. It would have to be probably determined by how well this book does. I think both Spock and McCoy would be both books that I'd like to write. I think the Spock, both of them present a problem that the Kirk book did not present, which is Spock lived another 80 years after Kirk dies in the Nexus. So you're suddenly right. There's a lot more to fill in. But what's interesting is there's a lot of really interesting stuff to fill in, because what you could do with a Spock book, which would be really interesting, I think, is Spock is there for the coming of the Next Generation.
So, definitely.
That Next Generation history, he could really be part of all that. What was Next Generation history? The Cardassian War and, everything, and he also, as we know, Spock, as we know, gets married sometime in the 24th century. Mm. You guys remember that?
Oh, yeah. The Picard mentions meeting Sarek at his son's wedding, I believe.
At his son's wedding, the best line, like one of the best lines ever. And, and it's like, all right, who's that? Who does Spock marry? Is Leila Kolomi still alive? That, to me is like, and then you've got lots of great stuff to talk about, Leila Kolomi, and then you've got life on Vulcan for which I think has been covered by a bunch of authors, but it'd be interesting to see it from his point of view. The other thing that I feel has never been seen, although maybe you guys can tell me that it's been covered in the lit universe, is Spock at Starfleet Academy. And what's it like for him there as probably the only Vulcan in his class? What is that like for him? And then what's it like for him on the Enterprise under Pike? Pike obviously means a lot to him. Yet, when Spock really doesn't come into his humanity till he serves with Kirk. So what is limited about his time on Enterprise? So there's like a lot of really interesting stuff to cover, but then you've also got 80 years to fill in up to the time Spock slips into that black hole to go to the JJ universe. So.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think the only thing that we have for Spock at the Academy is actually William Shatner's book. Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but in Collision Course where Kirk and Spock apparently meet in Shatner's book, that's the only one I can really think of where you get, a lot of Spock at the Academy.
Yeah, I hate to say I haven't actually read that one. I think on the back cover blurb, they mentioned that, yeah.
So here's a test for you guys. There is a whole little puzzle in there in my book, which I mentioned on the BBS, if you're reading it, about Kirk's Andorian roommate at the Academy. And it's a mixture of animated series, Prime Universe, and JJ's, and it's a puzzle. I don't want to give anything away, but I wondered if either of you figured it out.
Well, I got that because the Andorian roommate is the Andorian replacement for Spock in the animated episode where he died as a child, I believe.
Right.
And
that's right, Salem. So you got that.
Yeah, so I thought it was really cool that in this timeline he quit the Academy, basically. Well,
Why did he quit the Academy?
Oh shoot! I remember this when I was reading, and I'm slipping my mind.
He
now.
Was kicked out. He was. I'll give it to you. He failed the Kobayashi Maru. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right. Because Spock had designed the test. So in the universe that Spock.
So in our universe. Spock designed, and I don't say explicitly that Spock designed the Kobayashi Maru because, I didn't want to unnecessarily piss fans off, but but I love that. I love that Spock designed the Kobayashi Maru. I thought that was terrific. And so this idea that Spock designs the Kobayashi Maru and that Andorian gets kicked out of Starfleet Academy because he fails it, I thought was a great sort of little puzzle, which now I've given away, but I that was one fun little thing that I did.
Yeah, it's always fun when authors create things in there that you really have to be paying attention for. And anytime somebody wants to reference TAS, that's pretty awesome.
Here, yeah. Doesn't get a lot of love, and it deserves it.
I'm sorry, what were you saying, Dan?
I was just saying that it seems to not get a lot of love sometimes, but it really does deserve it, especially an episode like Yesteryear.
Yeah, well, as I said on the BBS, if I did a Spock book, Yesteryear would definitely be part of it. That you couldn't avoid that, because that's such a great story.
That's honestly one of Spock's most poignant stories when it comes to, you know, all of TOS and what we kind of learn about that character, honestly.
Yeah.
If you, you know, you were talking about what you would have to do to fill in for a Spock book. I really feel like you'd have your work cut out for you the same way with a McCoy book, because, I mean, he also lives all the way to, you know, we see the launch of the Enterprise D, and he's still alive.
No, that's true. I mean, I'm sort of taking one step at a time. I think that if I could get to do a second book, it would be Spock next. So I'm thinking about that more than I'm thinking about McCoy. You also have to, how is McCoy still a Southern gentleman in the 23rd century? How is the South existing, that culture, you know? And then, and also you get one of Dax's predecessors meets McCoy, right, at Old Miss.
Oh, yes, so she does. He had the hands too, of a surgeon.
And then, but you're right, what is McCoy? Spock is a little easier because, you know, he becomes an ambassador. And, well, you know, because he's a captain of the Enterprise, so he's going to be a captain, and then he's going to be an ambassador, and he's going to try to reunify the Romulans, and there's all the conflict with his dad, and all that stuff that would fill in a book, I think, quite nicely. McCoy is much, I think, tougher, but also fun because you get to make it all up. Who is this guy for the next 80 years after Kirk died?
David, what are obviously people need to go pick up the autobiography of James T. Kirk, but what are some of the other things that you're working on right now? And of course, also let everybody know where they can find you online and talk to you about the book.
Well, I did go on the Trek PBS pretty regularly looking for people to chat with the book. And I think people sometimes they don't really engage with me, but I am always happy to engage with people. I don't have a website or anything. I suppose I should. Maybe I'll set that up at some point. But I'm currently a writer at Family Guy, where I've worked on and off for the last 15 years. And it's a great place to work. It's a very different kind of writing than writing the Star Trek book. That's essentially my day job. It's a great day job. I'm hoping to continue these books. I would love to get to write the Spock book. I'm also working on a couple of other projects that are still a little new and so aren't really worth talking about. But I guess the BBS, the Trek BBS, well, as you guys want to recommend somewhere else to go to talk about the book, I'm kind of new to this. I guess I should set up my own website, huh?
Well, yeah, we'll definitely have people, and we'll be talking about it on our listeners' discussion group there on Facebook.
Oh, okay, good.
At the Babel Conference. So we'll be talking about there or on Trek FM's Facebook page.
I'll be happy to join you there. I'll definitely take a look and engage if anybody wants to.
Yeah,
I would
that's
be happy
awesome,
to have
man.
You there for sure.
Well, I'm really glad that we got an opportunity to connect with you, and it was fun reading through the book. One of the things that I really enjoyed about the book, too, that obviously happened with Federation First 150 Years was the nice artwork that went along with the book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really liked that. You know, you had Kirk's Academy picture and some his driver's license, some other things like that. And just it really added to, I felt like, the feel of the story. You know, when you pick up an autobiography or a biography of somebody, it always has that middle part that has the pictures. And I really liked that touch because it made it feel more like a real, you know, autobiography of somebody that you would just pick up when you were searching around in a Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, those illustrations were done by a very talented artist named Russell Walks, who he's done a lot of really great I wish I had his website, but look for him, Russell Walks, WALKS. He designed all that stuff. A lot of that was his ideas that he just sort of ran by me. The thing that I love was I had the idea of the Academy photo and I wrote Kirk's diploma, but his contribution was that great page of photos of Kirk and Edith Keeler with the little mementos. He designed all of those and the Kirk ID card from Traveling to Tarsus 4 with the young picture of William Shatner. I mean, all that stuff was a very talented artist, and he's done a lot of really cool Star Wars posters.
Excellent. Yeah, no, and another thing I just wanted to mention really quickly that I'd forgotten was one of the things that really led a lot of realism to it was the editor's notes, kind of correcting little things throughout the book. I thought it was a really nice touch.
Yeah, well, that was something that I'd done in Federation, the first book, and I really enjoyed that because it gave a sense that, you know, that the person writing this book is writing something. In the sense of Federation, the idea was I was getting to fill in stuff. That actually, the way it started, not to talk too long about it, but the way the whole idea started of doing editor's notes was I had to figure out some way in Federation to include the eugenics wars. That had to be part of a history book of the Federation. But we all lived through the 1990s. There was no eugenics wars. So that bothered me because for me, when you're doing this sort of role play in a book, you want to believe that the Star Trek future might still happen and that somehow this history book can exist as a history book in our universe. And so I explained it in a footnote. I basically imply that somebody went back in time and maybe created an alternate universe where the eugenics wars didn't happen. And I do it very subtly, but that was my way of sort of solving a problem that I had as a writer. And then I realized that it's a great way to add information that doesn't quite fit in the narrative. And then during the autobiography book, I realized what this allowed me to do was to have Kirk get some things wrong. And that made him seem, again, more human. It's not a perfect book. So the editor says, oh, he thinks it's Jonathan Archer, but it's Henry Archer, or, you know, he's getting this wrong, or he, you know, there's all these sort of editor's notes throughout that are the idea being there was a discussion about this book and that Kirk might have gotten some of his facts wrong, and that made him seem more human.
Yeah, it really does add something to a book that I think a lot of fans are just going to eat up. And again, I think it's a great book as, you know, as long as somebody knows who Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are, it's a good book to give to somebody.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you for saying so. Not my sister, but anybody else.
Well, awesome. David, thank you so much for coming on and talk about the book. I love the behind the scenes and I mean, obviously taking on a book of this kind of magnitude is tough, you know, with the kind of person and character that Kirk is to so many people. And it's always great to hear how an author comes to the decisions they make and why. And I think it's a good, successful book for people. And I hope that it'll be successful because I would really like to see, you know, that Spock biography and that McCoy biography too.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your enthusiasm, and it's always nice to hear that somebody actually liked the book. So I hope more people do, but thank you so much for having me on and talking to me about it. It's a lot of fun.
Well, thanks so much for being on the show. We really appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
Well, Matthew, I had a lot of fun talking with David Goodman, the editor, not the author of the autobiography of James T. Kirk. The author, of course, being the man, the legend himself, Captain James T. Kirk.
When you're writing a book about the man, the myth, and the legend, how do you edit them and say, we're going to have to put an editor's note here because you got that wrong? I guess it's maybe good that he got lost in the Nexus so he couldn't correct any of the mistakes. You know, you could get really upset about that.
Yeah, that was, I would imagine that it would be hard to look James T. Kirk in the face and say, actually, you're wrong about that. That's the Henry Archer building, not the Jonathan Archer building.
Yeah. I feel like he might just glare at you and or like karate chop you so you wake up like a day later. Yeah, it's probably not a good idea. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed the discussion. It was a lot of fun getting the background information and, you know, just taking on a project like that. So I'm glad David came on to talk to us about it. I wanted to remind everybody, obviously, that you can find all of our shows at iTunes.com/TrekFM, and we'd really appreciate it if you'd give us a star rating review. It helps us grow, the show grow, it makes us more visible, and it's only you, the listener, can really make that happen. So go over to iTunes, give us a review. But if you're not on iTunes and you'd like to listen to the shows, remember that you can find us all over the place. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from the website and grab the RSS link as well. Now, two big thanks for guys who bring this show to you each week. It's Will Wynn and Ken Tripp, and it's because of their support on Patreon that this show comes to you each week. And these guys have been with us in the show for so long, and if you would like to help out the show the way they do, go to patreon.com/trekfm. We are a listener-supported network, and that means that we run off the support that we get from the listeners. It also means that we don't have to do a ton of ads on the shows. They get to be pretty clean. You get to enjoy what you're listening to without being assaulted by all these different things. If you like that and you love what we do and have a passion for the things that we talk about, go to patreon.com/trekfm. Help support the network and keep all of this content coming to you. And we got some great perks for you. You can have early access to content like the guys do here on the show every week. They get to hear Literary Treks before anybody else. Exclusive content. You could be on the Patreon roundtable and so much more. And again, just go to patreon.com/trekfm to see how you can help keep this network coming to you each and every week. Now, Dan, when you're not sitting around with a glass of Saurian brandy or trying to write your memoirs, where can we find you?
Well, Matthew, I do enjoy a good glass of Saurian brandy every once in a while. But when I'm not indulging, you can find me online. I'm at www.treklit.com, and there you'll find my website where I review Star Trek novels, both old and new. I'm on facebook.com/treklitreviews and Twitter at Treklit Reviews and at Kertrats, which is my personal Twitter feed, and that's Kertrats, and also on Instagram at Kertrats47. And Matthew, when you're not trying to avoid Finnegan's latest prank, where can we find you?
I hate that guy. He's such a jerk. Ugh. You can find me probably complaining about him on Twitter at MattRushing02, taking pictures of the mayhem that he created on Instagram at MRushing. You can also find me doing The Orb with Christopher Jones, who may or may not be a part of the Star Trek universe now, at least the literary universe, because of James Swallow. Just check that out. You can find me doing The 602 Club. It's the place where we talk about all things geeky but don't have to do with Star Trek, and it's a great place to have a good time with all the geek things that we love but we don't necessarily get to talk about in our other Star Trek shows. So we pick a new topic each week. It's a lot of fun. We try to introduce people to things they may have never tried, and it's just a great place to be. So come hang out with us and Ruby, and of course you can find me on my own personal blog as well, at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, live long and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.